And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Thursday, August 10th, 2023. An international human rights group says evidence shows South Sudan soldiers were involved in extrajudicial killings.
We acknowledge the fact that South Sudan's People's Defense Forces at the time in August launched its own investigation. We have not seen the findings of that investigation.
And MSF pitches in to help Upper Nile residents prepare for heavy rains.
So joint efforts by authorities, donors, and the humanitarian community are needed, both to ensure that people have access to medical care, but also to anticipate and address the consequences of future climate change.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Human Rights Watch is urging the government to hold soldiers responsible for last year's extrajudicial killings of rebel soldiers in Unity State. Human Rights Watch says tangible evidence shows the South Sudan Army committed crimes in Mayim County. Lucy Pony reports for VOA from Nairobi.
The killings took place during counterinsurgency operations launched by the governor of Unity State in August last year, following reported attacks by the South Sudan Patriotic Movement, or SSPM, in which 12 people were killed, including the county commissioner of Mayom. Human Rights Watch Africa Division researcher Nyago Atut says, despite the army investigation of the extrajudicial killings and reports submitted to the presidency, the army's findings have never been made public.
We acknowledge the fact that South Sudan's People's Defense Forces at the time in August launched its own investigation. We have not seen the findings of that investigation. They handed over their report to President Salva Kiir at the end of August last year. President Salva Kiir proceeded to establish an investigation committee, which looked into the various incidences around both the attack on the villages as well as on the killings of these fighters. But there has nothing since that time. It is not clear how extensive the mandate of the committee was, how much, what information they were able to gather, and what has happened to that investigation.
Speaking to VOA today, South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe says the government investigations into the Mayom killings are not finished.
They are taking our measures and we are continuing with the measures. This is a big case that needs thorough investigation and trial. We cannot put the cart before the horse and start talking of the measures that we are taking at a time when we are continuing with the legal proceedings.
Nyagwa says Human Rights Watch findings make it clear that army soldiers and national security officers were involved in the killings.
Our findings show the involvement of South Sudanese soldiers as well as a national security officer, some soldiers who were uniformed and a few others who were not, who were wearing plain clothes. It was very clear from the video footage that at least three of the individuals were shot on the spot and may have died as a result. And in fact, interviews with family members do indicate that the individuals died after that incident and that their bodies were buried in that location.
Nyagwa says previous committees commissioned to investigate such cases have operated in secrecy and their reports rarely made public. She says governments are obliged under international law to appropriately prosecute apparent war crimes.
This is not the only incident where either government officials or soldiers or high-ranking members in the government are implicated in human rights abuses. But the country or the leadership turns a blind eye to these incidences time and time again. And so what happens is that it emboldens people who are responsible to continue conducting these violations. And so the trend of impunity tends to continue because there's no action to hold people to account.
Human Rights Watch says such cases underscore the need for South Sudan's government and the African Union Commission to finally form the hybrid court for South Sudan as laid out in the 2018 peace deal to prosecute the most serious human rights violations. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony in Nairobi.
The French medical charity Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, is helping South Sudanese in Upper Nile State prepare for flooding ahead of the rainy season. An MSF official in South Sudan says her organization hopes to save lives before the heavy rains arrive over the next few months. Deng Gai Jeng has the story for VOA from Bor.
In May, the UN predicted with the heavy rains that hit the Lake Victoria Basin, recently combined later this year with El Nino, which is the warming of the sea surface temperature caused by climate change, Upper Nile State will experience severe flooding in the coming months. Luz Linares, MSF head of mission in South Sudan, says the country has not yet recovered from the effects of previous year's flooding. She says reaching people in need has become increasingly difficult as floods wash away covered roads, bridges, and airstrips.
Last year, larger than ever parts of South Sudan were covered in water, and in some places the waters have still not receded. For instance, in Bentiu Unity Estate, the camp for displaced people is in fact an island protected by dikes. While some villages also in Olfangak, Jonglei Estate, they are still underwater. The floods cut off many areas from the dry land, preventing people from accessing healthcare services.
Linares says MSF has distributed 11 canoes to 11 villages in Upper Nile State to help them transport sick people and expectant mothers during the June to October rainy season. Linares says this is the new normal.
Given the scale of flooding in the past 4 years in South Sudan, it seems that massive floods are a new reality for the country. So joint efforts by authorities, donors, and the humanitarian community are needed, both to ensure that people have access to medical care, but also to anticipate and address the consequences of future climate change in the region.
Angao Biech, a community chief in Aria village in Upper Nile State, says the canoe that MSF provided to his village could be the difference between life and death when the floods begin.
Happy for the support given to us by the MSF. This boat will help save lives of the people. We also appeal to the other NGOs to come and support the village with food.
Linares says MSF teams have also been putting medical supplies in position in locations across the country, including Upper Nile, with a focus on the most vulnerable. Peter Pal, Deputy Director of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, ORRC, in the state, says his office is educating both locals and returnees about the dangers of flooding.
We informed the 13 county commissioners. We call the people to be ready where there is some activities which are now going on for the flood in Maban. The UN and the SRRC in Maban, they start their work.
A floods assessment report published by the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in April shows flooding over the past 4 years affected more than 2 million people across the country. The SSRRC said the floods pose serious challenges to peace building, development, and all of the affected populations. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng. In Juba.
Health workers in Unity State are expressing concern about the large number of people suffering from psychological trauma. The person who runs Bentiu Hospital says many trauma victims in the country have lost loved ones as well as property during the conflict. Leith Nyak Jok has the details for VOA from Bentiu.
War survivor Bitankok, whose father committed suicide by hanging himself after he has lost his property last year, saying people of all age are traumatized in his community.
Many people were traumatized by issue of property. They were thinking about the property taken during the conflict and disappear. If you have a goat, it is also killed by the flood water. Even me, the person who is talking to you, my father, a property. When his property taken, I was unable to control him, he hung himself.
Some citizens blame the high number of traumatic cases on the severe economic hardship people face, coupled with a chronic food insecurity. Dr. Michael Kwangwell, a medical director at Bentiu Hospital, say psychological trauma ran high among the internally displaced person sheltering at the UN run protection of civilian side because they have lost loved one, they have lost their property, and they don't get the medicine they need to survive.
The level of trauma to our state is really very high. There's many causes of trauma. Even this war that really make us to be in one place, especially in enemies. Some it can cause a trauma. Sometimes even your property, if they are really taken, it can cause a psychological problem.
Dr. Kwan say the hospital receive about 4 trauma patients per month. He say he believe most people requiring a treatment for a psychological trauma have yet to seek a medical help.
If you really feel somebody who is related to you have a symptom that is not relevant to the situation that is using before, advise him to seek for psychiatric review.
Quilgen Bangwang, an assistant officer for mental health and psychological support project run by an international organization for migration, say the agency support more than 10,000 individuals in the IDPs and the host community affected by psychological trauma. She says fast and ongoing violence in the country has negatively affected the psychological well-being of many South Sudanese.
People who to cope with a loss, it could be loss of the human loss, could be the material loss, loss of family members and others' livelihood, and family disruption and disconnection from their community support system.
Geng also say a lot of women and girls in United States are traumatized after suffering from sexual abuse, including rape. A teenager girl who is attending counseling session at an IOM facility and prepared to remain anonymous for fear of refusal from relatives say she feels relief after receiving counseling.
When our property got spoiled in the flood water, we think a lot and lost control. Before, we have lost many things during the flooding. When IOM help us with psychosocial support, we are happy.
The IOM has run the psychological project in the United States since 2016. It provides individual, family, and group to support the victim of trauma. For VOA News, I'm Lee Nyaja, reporting from Bentiu, United States.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, another deadly shipwreck off the Italian coast prompts the question, what can be done to help migrants that keep coming from Africa?
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. UNICEF has confirmed that most people on a boat that recently capsized off the coast of Italy had traveled from countries that included Guinea, Mali, Senegal, and Ivory Coast. 41 people reportedly died off the Italian coast. In another shipwreck this past weekend in the Mediterranean, a pregnant mother and an 18-month-old child from Africa were among those who died off the coast of Lampedusa, Italy. UNICEF country coordinator for the national response in Italy, Nicola De Alcipreda, tells me around 30 people are still missing.
What we heard from the survivors of the shipwreck is that a number of people were on board, about 45 of them. They left from Sfax on Thursday or Friday last week. during their journey, somewhere in the Mediterranean, we don't know the exact location, the ship capsized. And the survivors saw the other people traveling with them progressively sink in the sea. They managed to remain afloat, and apparently they have found an abandoned iron barge until they've been rescued by a cargo ship that was passing by and subsequently disembarked with the help of the Coast Guard in Lampedusa.
UNICEF says a young child and a pregnant mother from Africa were among the victims. Is that correct?
Well, that's actually, sadly, the outcome of another shipwreck that took place also over the weekend. Unfortunately, we've seen this route of the Central Mediterranean putting in danger so many lives, and we have seen so many shipwrecks taking place over the years. Only this year, at least 289 children lost their lives or have gone missing trying to get to Italy from the southern part of the Mediterranean. What we know is that this trend has continued steadily, if not increased, which also shows that people are taking huge risks. And this means they're really facing really tough hardship at home if they're ready to take such a terrible risk to come all the way.
If that's the case and people are continuing to take these big risks, risk their lives to get over to the European continent, what are you advising at least people to do that are coming from Africa?
Well, there is no way around. Either we have safe legal pathways established so that migrants have a safe option to travel, and at the same time, we have stronger search and rescue operations at sea, or we will keep seeing children dying.
And how is that going to happen? Is that up to the governments of Europe?
Yeah, we are advocating for this on governments, on the European Union, and we hope action will be taken as soon as possible.
Otherwise, people are going to continue to die.
Exactly.
Is there anything you wanted to add that I didn't ask you that you feel is important to mention?
Yeah, I'd like to say that what we know is that more than 70% of the children arriving are unaccompanied, are separated from their parents. They're traveling alone. So many of them have spent months traveling, facing sexual exploitation, all sorts of abuse and violence. What we have to ensure is that when they arrive, we need to provide them with adequate reception condition. We are there with our team to listen to them and also to refer them to the appropriate services. What we are asking is that as soon as possible, they are transferred from Lampedusa towards more suitable reception facilities and to have full access to the health services.
That is UNICEF Country Coordinator for the National Response in Italy, Nicola De Archipreta. He was speaking with me earlier today from Rome. South African government sources have told VOA that they're pushing for the expulsion of the United States ambassador to Pretoria. In May, Ruben Brigati accused the administration of President Cyril Ramaphosa of providing Russia with weapons for use in Ukraine. But a judge appointed by Ramaphosa to investigate the claims has found that South Africa did not supply any war material to Moscow. Instead, says the judge, it was Russia that provided guns and bullets to South Africa for its special forces to use against insurgents in northern Mozambique. Darren Taylor reports.
International relations analyst and former U.S. diplomat to several African countries, Brooks Spector, says it's possible Pretoria just wants a formal apology from Brigati and from Washington. But he says that'll only happen when and if the U.S. government acknowledges its intelligence was wrong and that South Africa indeed did not provide arms to Russia last December. That's when, according to American intelligence reports, a sanctioned Russian vessel, the Lady R, was loaded with weapons and ammunition destined for Ukraine at a naval base near Cape Town.
Remember, too, that the report on the Lady R, none of it's been made public. There have been some leaks saying that, yes, they received weapons that had been ordered previously, and it was then loaded with food bound for Russia. Now, I'm scratching my head a little bit trying to figure out why in the world they loaded food onto it in a naval base. Until such time as it is publicly explained what was found, we're still in a bit of a black box on this one. We don't really know.
Presidential spokesman Vincent Magwenya says Ramaphosa is still studying the judge's report. After that, he says the president will decide what, if anything, to release publicly, since much of the report concerns state security. International relations spokesman for the governing African National Congress, Obed Bapela, says no matter what the facts are, Brigati acted improperly and the government can no longer trust him.
When such a matter arises by any ambassador who is accredited to South Africa, there's what we call diplomatic channels. The ambassador Brigati did not use those diplomatic channels. He might have apologized for raising it in a RAND platform. He knows this protocol arrangement that exists as a global phenomenon. He should have then gone to that, and so that the Minister of International Relations in South Africa and her counterpart in the U.S. can then engage on the matter and find a diplomatic channel of raising and attending and investigating the matter until there's a conclusive evidence on the matter.
If Pretoria keeps its report secret, says Spectre, Washington would be well within its rights to stand by its intelligence and to refuse to apologize or recall its ambassador. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Organization of African Unity, or OAU as it's called, was formally established in 1963 by 32 independent African leaders. Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie's foreign minister at that time, Ketema Yifru, is said to have played a major role in the creation of the OAU. His son, Mekonnen Ketema, has penned a biography about his father's achievements. In part one of their two-part conversation, he talks with VOA Africa News Tonight show host Yehias Wuhib about his father's life.
And once they finished the high school, the government decided that, you know, the good students, the students that got good grades, we excelled, basically were given the opportunity to study abroad. And as such, my father found himself in Michigan, America, nice. Holland, Michigan. And he studied political science in Hope College. He got his first degree there. And then he had to get a second degree, of course, his master's. He went to Boston University, completed his studies there. He got his master's in Boston University. He actually did an internship while he was there at the UN, which helped.
Yes.
And then he got back to Addis. And this was around 1952, where he joined the foreign ministry for a few years.
So from 1961 to 1972, according to your book,
yes,
your father, as Ethiopia's foreign affairs minister, embarked on a journey,
yes,
a mission, if you will.
Yes.
That saw the creation of the Organization of African Unity, the OAU. My question is, how did that idea germinate in his mind to create an organization dealing with more than, what, 32 African countries at that time, to convince these leaders on a new concept of a united African organization? Talk to us about that.
So, you know, he started off in 61 by stating that at the UN, he's stating that, you know, Africa needed an organization, that because, you know, in order for us to solve our problems, you know, we needed that organization. And, you know, that whole concept of African problems, needs, African solutions. So that's how we started off. So there was a divide in the continent, and he had to go around 32 countries to...
So he actually went to 32 individual countries and talked to 32 individual leaders?
Their leaders and their foreign ministers as well. He had to convince them that, you know, there's a meeting in Addis. We have planned a meeting in May, that you all have to come and participate. And through that, there will be some kind of unity, and we'll create an organization as well. They were convinced, and they came.
So now let's talk about the shuttle diplomacy and the closed-door negotiations that went on in dealing with, I call them, the two elephants in the room.
Yeah.
As you know, the Casablanca group and the Monrovia group.
Sure, yeah.
And you have a very extensive chapter on that. And basically what you say is the Casablanca group was formed in 1961 by Ghana, Guinea, Mali, and later joined by Egypt, Morocco, and Algeria, led by President Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. And the Casablanca group was seeking immediate unity in the continent. And then we have the Monrovia group, which was formed in 1961 as well by Liberia, Somalia, Togo, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Sierra Leone, Libya, and Tunisia. And members of the Monrovia group rejected the idea of immediate unity. So there were diametrically opposite viewpoints, but at the end of the day, your father joined these two divergent groups into one.
And these were big leaders. You know, we're talking about Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, Modibo Keita, and Tafawa Balewa on the other side, you know. Houphouet Boigné, you know, these are big, big names and charismatic leaders who stuck to their ideas, like Kwame Nkrumah, you know, he wanted unity now. And they said no. So, and a few things happened too during that time. The president of Togo was killed during a coup d'etat. So that even made it worse, one blaming the other. So the situation was really bad when my father went out to ask them to come to Addis. And some were not even in speaking terms. But he convinced them, though. He convinced them that, you know, and I believe there are several reasons. They know that he was a true Pan-Africanist because they've seen his work in freedom, you know, how he helped freedom fighters and how he was advocating for the continent. And he had made very good friends with the leaders and their foreign ministers. So I think that helped him a lot. And he had this personality as well. And he had the knack of convincing people to see it his way.
That is Mekonnen Khetema. He's the author of a biography about his father, Khetema Yefru. He was speaking with my colleague, Yehias Wuhib. And that wraps it up for this Thursday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you happen to miss this broadcast, head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Dodo by a group from Lokoya, Eastern Equatoria State. I've been listening to the song Dodo by a group from Lokoya, Eastern Equatoria State. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam, in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Joe Gill, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm not gonna let you go.
Madarana.